Okay, so I want to again thank the organizers for inviting me here. And what I want to do, I thought it was a 20-minute talk, but I can probably make it a little longer, but I think not many people over here want me to make it very much longer, so I'll be somewhere in between 20 and 30 minutes. So I want to talk about some unusual systems which may or may not fit into the paradigm of what you've heard about here over the last week. But nevertheless, I hope you'll be entertained. So I want to tell you about particular interfaces, first by giving you some examples of where they arise, why I got interested in them. Well, the answer to the second question is because curiosity more than anything else. Then I want to actually talk a little bit about trying to understand how you might characterize them. What are the mechanical properties? Do they behave like fluids? Do they behave like solids? And in fact, I'm going to do that by showing you a series of interesting observations, some of which started literally in our kitchen at home, and then we started quantifying it in the lab. And the people who helped with that were Dominic Vella, who's a graduate student, in fact, with Herbert Huppert now, Pascal Ossiou, who was now in Marseille, and Denis Richard, who is now working for Vivendi Water, whatever that is now. And then I want to very briefly, but I won't spend much detail because it's really irrelevant as far as the audience over here goes, tell you about some interesting instabilities, morphological instabilities of how paint, for example, dries, which of course everybody knows is very boring. And I will actually confirm that. But I'll show you some beautiful images. And I might have some time at the end to actually tell you something about what happens when you have suspensions or, in fact, interfaces of granular materials with something else. You've seen a lot of that, and I want to basically ask a question about whether there is some effective interfacial tension that you can actually impart to these in the vein of trying to make continuum theories for them. So I want to tell you about examples where it arises, where these particular surfaces arise. And in fact, the way I learned about this was from Pascal Ossiou, who was actually trying to make non-wetting drops to actually verify some theories that I had made with Yves Pommeau a few years ago. And the question was the following. If I have basically, for example, honey and I have cocoa and I mix them, the honey could actually be a drop, the cocoa could be on the outside. If the honey is not completely wetting the cocoa, what are the properties of this drop? Essentially, that's the kind of example that we played with in the kitchen. Pascal was more sophisticated than that. So I want to basically start with a description of that. So this is essentially not honey or cocoa, it's just polystyrene beads, which you may be barely able to make out over here, about 200 microns, essentially covering an entire interface. I usually have a demonstration. I didn't dare come with white powder in the plane. Anyway, this is a biological example of the same thing. This is an aphid. It's a little insect which lives in plant galls. Plant galls are cancer-like tissues which you find often in plants. And the aphids have a very interesting problem. In fact, all insects have a very interesting problem that they have to actually solve, which is how to prevent themselves from drowning. Because if you touch water, then in fact, the surface tension forces, given their size, the size of an aphid is about the order of a millimeter, is small enough that surface tension forces are very important, and therefore they basically have to fight to actually prevent themselves from drowning. How do they keep themselves dry? Well, one way is to just become hairy. Okay. Another way, it turns out, which I'll tell you about, involves actually particulate interface, and this is in fact an aphid marble. Aphid over here, these are what we call aphid marbles. These are actually droplets of the aphid feces, and I'll tell you something very interesting about it that related to a problem that they've solved, which actually involves physics and helps with physiology. I won't really spend a whole lot of time about on this kind of particulate interface, which essentially involves a droplet, for example, in David Edwards' lab or David Waite's lab at Harvard, a droplet with some particles in it, non-Brownian or Brownian particles, you dry it. If you dry it very slowly, what's going to happen is you're going to get a clump. If you dry it very quickly, so quickly in the sense of you're taking the water out faster than there is time for the particles to homogenize inside the drop, then in fact the particles get frozen at some location and form a shell. And when you form the shell, and then you start removing water some more, what happens is that you get an instability. So this is a particulate material originally, a suspension, which transitions via some sort of jamming and a very short-range attractive potential to something which forms a shell, and then the shell itself starts to desiccate. Well, this is interesting from a purely scientific point of view, but it's even more interesting from a technological point of view. David Edwards started a company called Advanced Inhalation Research, and what they basically use this for is to deliver drugs very deep down in the lungs. And the reason for that is, of course, you have a large amount of surface area. The mass is very small, so you don't actually get adhered. You don't adhere. The particles don't adhere to any part of your respiratory tract because they are big, and you can force them very far because they don't have much mass. So you can get them very deep down. So a question that these people asked is, can you actually say something about controlling these morphologies? In principle, you want to basically have something which is very large and yet very light, so that it can actually encapsulate whatever it is that you want. And the final example, which I hope to spend a few minutes more on, is the question of what would happen if I actually dry, instead of drying a droplet, I think about drying paint. And this is a cartoon version of that. So in this is an experiment, again, done by actually in David Waitz's lab by Eric Dufresne, where you have a thin layer of suspension between two glass plates, one end of which is wet, so in contact with a moist environment, and it's drying from the other side. It's actually confined on these two sides. So basically, you dry it from one side, you lose water. Losing water causes very large capillary stresses to develop in this suspension. As you actually start to dry, these stresses essentially break the suspension, and you start to see cracks form, and the cracks propagate. One question, many questions you can ask about this. One is, for example, can you actually say anything about the dynamics of these cracks, because they're actually moving through relatively soft, wet media. Okay, first question that I need to address is, what would happen if I have just particles on an interface which are floating? Okay. And in fact, this is a problem which has been studied a lot. In fact, I think in today's Nature, there was something interesting. I didn't have a chance to look at it in great detail. If I have particles at an interface, then if they have even the slightest amount of weight, they deform the interface. And if they deform the interface, then you basically have set up a meniscus, and then you can have attractive or repulsive forces associated with that. So for example, if I am in the neighborhood of a wall, then if I have a particle over here, and the particle is relatively small so that it can simply float, it would actually tend to be attracted to the wall. And the simplest way of thinking about this, which actually goes back to Nicholson in the 1940s, is to say that it essentially is going up this. If you look at it from above, it looks like there's an attractive force. Over here, in fact, you can see from the side, it's just buoyancy. It's actually pulling this up. A similar thing will happen if I have two particles which are interacting with each other. If I have either a contact angle, which actually gives you this kind of meniscus, or if they're relatively heavy. On the other hand, if one is heavy and one is light, or if the contact angles, such as one is hydrophobic and another one is hydrophilic, then in fact you can see that the meniscus in between will not be the leading order a quadratic, but a cubic, and that will actually cause repulsion. So you can either play with weight, or you can play with chemistry to actually change from attraction to repulsion. And as I said, this is well known in some communities, but in some textbooks, in fact, it's not completely well understood. And the most beautiful explanation that I've seen of this actually is an old textbook called The Properties of Matter by Thompson and Poynting. So I want to go and look at this particulate raft and actually tell you about some properties and then try and understand these properties. So question one, is it a solid or is it a liquid? Okay. Is that raft a solid or liquid? Why does it actually come together? I told you, because I have this attractive interaction, if they're all of the same kind. So this is the raft that I showed you. This is a different size polystyrene bead. And what you do, what we did, actually again, more or less by accident, is you basically push the ends together. Okay. Why did we want to do that? Well, the signature of a solid, the simplest signature of a solid, is that it actually has a zero frequency shear modulus. So if I actually push it, it can sustain an anisotropic stress. Okay. They are, as to the eye, they are effectively as close as you can get in contact. There is a certain amount of polydispersity, there is roughness, and so what we can see is essentially they are in contact. So they will come together until they touch each other, effectively. Okay. So. Here is our schematic. Okay, so it's essentially a trough. This is what? This is your layer, and you basically introduce a little plate, and then you push it. And it's confined in this direction and that direction, the other two directions. Large. So the layer of the thickness is centimeters, the undulations are typically millimeters at most. Okay. the schematic experiment, in fact, that's the actual experiment, the schematic of the experiment is what I was just asked a question about. You actually have this confined in the outer plane direction as well as in the plane, and then you move one boundary. And if you move this boundary and you look at it from above, you basically see that you can see it, that the surface wrinkles and it stays wrinkled. Okay, if it was a fluid, if it was a viscous fluid, in fact, it will also wrinkle on short time scales. But in fact, if I wait long enough, it will thicken. Over here, if I wait long enough, nothing changes. The wrinkles actually are sustained. So this is one piece of evidence which says that, in fact, I'm able to support a compression in this direction, which in general will be different from the stress in that direction, which actually causes this thing to buckle. And so it's the signature, perhaps, of a solid. Okay, now I want to emphasize that this is an unusual granular material. First of all, it's two-dimensional, and secondly, it's a granular material which behaves like a solid because of the presence of a liquid. Okay, the capillary interactions are important because if the capillary interactions weren't there, if I basically took a layer of granular material and put it on the table and I just squished it, it'll either buckle, come out of the plane and sit on top of each other, or just remain in the plane. This wavelength, which I'll indicate, which I'll show you quantitatively in a little bit, is in fact quite large compared to the particle size. So in fact, that's good because you may be able to use and get away with something like a continuum theory. So you already know from dimensional analysis, which I will go on to indicate a little more quantitatively, that if I have an energy, in this case energy per unit area, which is interfacial tension, and I have a particle diameter, from these two I can just construct a modulus, which is just the ratio of those two. Which in fact will turn out to be correct, but we have to actually do a little bit more work to actually show that this is true. A second kind of experiment, if I have a solid, again, trying to show that it's able to actually sustain an anisotropic stress, is in the context of not pushing it and buckling it, but just cracking it. If I crack a solid, it's actually relieving the stress in one direction, but not necessarily in the other direction. So that's also a signature, a clear signature that it's actually a solid. And again, I have to make sure that it's not time dependent. So a very simple way of cracking it is, again, something that you can do in your kitchen, is to actually take a needle and then rub it between your fingers so that you get some oil. And then you take the oil and then you just put it inside this cocoa honey mixture, or lycopodium powder and water. And what you see is, in fact, a crack, or many cracks actually grow. They grow, turns out, intermittently. I don't have time to tell you about all the details of that. And they stay. Okay. In fact, I should say, perhaps I forgot to mention this, all that I'm saying is really an excuse to study the science of scum. Okay. Take what you mean. Anyway, so in the context of the crack propagation, I'll mention this, I won't come back to this at all. In fact, the crack turns out to actually move relatively quickly, but it actually moves intermittently. It doesn't move smoothly at all. It moves for a while, stops, moves for a while, stops. Okay, I don't want to say anything more about that, because that's going to go off on a tangent. So, I've given you some evidence that, in fact, these things behave like solids, and I want to actually try and deduce for you and then compare with experiments some very simple consequences of that. I've already told you all this. In fact, there is a cohesive interaction because of capillary forces, and that's a long-range, if you want, interaction solving a Laplace type equation. Then there is actually a short-range repulsion. So in fact, it is actually exactly what you would need in order to form a solid. And in fact, this is not a new view, except in the context of particles. 1947, I think, Bragg actually looked at bubble rafts. He basically made bubbles come to the interface between liquid and soap bubbles come to the interface between liquid and air. And he was interested in actually trying to make a macroscopic model to understand dislocations and fracture and so on and so forth. So all we are doing is actually repeating his experiments. The only difference is that basically I have particles. Okay, if bubbles, I actually do the same experiment and I compress it. Maybe I've indicated this somewhere or not. Yeah, I don't actually see buckling. What happens is the bubbles slide over each other and I start to stack. So presumably over here, the very fact that I have some interaction between them, which is able to sustain a stress in the transverse direction to prevent this sliding, is very important for it to behave like a solid. It's different, as I've already indicated, from the dry powders. It's also very different from a monolayer because there is no thermal motion. Okay, so is it a solid? Well, if it's a solid, it should actually have some properties, and seems like it has all the properties that we think it should. Now we want to actually quantify the simplest characterization of the solid. In fact, a tropic solid, I have two properties which completely characterize it. For example, the Young's modulus and the Poisson ratio. Okay. So the simplest way to actually think about the Poisson ratio is to say, basically, I'm going to ignore the details of all the interactions associated with non-central forces, which in general they will be because the particles are not perfectly spherical. But if I ignore that, I have central forces, and then in fact there's only one constant. Okay, it's known that basically if I have only central forces, I have only one constant, which completely determines the material. The other constant, in this case the Poisson ratio, just comes from geometry. And as I've told you before, from dimensional analysis, we can immediately write down that the Young's modulus must be gamma, the surface tension, divided by the diameter of the particle or the radius, times some dimensionless quantity. And that dimensionless quantity will have certainly some dependence on the volume fraction, and it will also have some dependence on the Poisson ratio. So can we go a little further than that? I'm not going to actually do that. Okay, you just think about the dimensional analysis. It's more or less sufficient to understand what's going on. And then what we did was to just do those experiments. You change the size of the particle, you push it, you measure the wavelength. Okay, change the size of the particle again, push it, measure the wavelength. Once you know the wavelength, you can back calculate what the elastic modulus ought to be, because you can do a very simple calculation. The calculation is that if I have now a particle raft, which is subject to gravity, which prevents long wavelength or penalizes long wavelength motions, and this effective elasticity, which penalizes short wavelength motions, which is actually now playing the role of able to sustain an anisotropic stress, I can solve a very simple equation. In fact, it's an exercise in Landau-Lifschitz, and I can get the wavelength in terms of the elastic modulus and gravity, and that's it. Okay. So once we have that, we can go back and fit it, okay? Fit it to the experiments, where the only unknown parameter now is either the bending stiffness or equivalently the Young's modulus, the Poisson ratio, and the thickness of the sheet. So I don't want to show you the calculation. All I want to show you is the result. This is the wavelength as a function of the size of the particles, and forgetting about all these details which come from a slightly more involved, but not very much more involved, calculation in terms of volume fraction, Poisson ratio. There are two lengths in the problem. There is the length which is associated with the particle size, and there is the capillary length, which comes from the balance of interfacial tension and gravity. So in fact, lambda must be related to these two lengths, and it turns out to be the geometric mean. So as I said earlier, in fact, it's large compared to the size of the particle, which means I can get away with a continuous approximation, and I can invert this data for lambda as a function of d using a formula for the buckling wavelength for a sheet which is subjected to gravity and has elasticity. And here's what you get. This is the Young's modulus of this layer as a function of the diameter of the particles, which is the straight line. The difference between the straight line and the dashed line is essentially a detail which depends on what you actually used to calculate this prefactor, which depends on the Poisson ratio and the volume fraction, the coverage, or aerial fraction. But to a first approximation, you're able to capture, not surprisingly, what this simple theory says over a few orders of magnitude. All right, so that's good. So I can actually characterize the elasticity. I have some very simple measure of the Young's modulus. I now want to actually completely switch and talk about these insects. Okay, so this is one bit. So as I said, I promise this is going to be really more phenomenology and little examples of where these rafts or particle layers come up. So I want to actually now switch to a completely different subject, but I hope still an interesting one. And I want to actually point out a couple of things over here. So this is the aphid that I showed you earlier. It's about a millimeter in size, and I told you already the problem that all insects face. That is, how to remain dry. One way to actually solve that problem is to be hairy. Another way to solve the problem is to actually use chemistry to have non-wetting surfaces. In fact, these guys use a third way, okay? And they discovered it 300 million years before we did, okay? So the third way is essentially the following. So first I have to explain something amazing, which was told to me by William Foster, who is an ecologist at Cambridge University. And he is interested in understanding how these insects actually work as groups. And he was particularly interested in a caste of insects called soldier aphids. And soldier aphids have two roles in life. One is obvious. The other one is actually to clean the nest, clean the plant gall. And here's the problem. Insects essentially consume sap. That's most of where they get all their nutrients from. And they also excrete mostly water. It's their digested sap. They have a lot of it that they generate. And if you're in an enclosed space, you have a problem. How do you actually get rid of this stuff? Soldier aphids essentially are responsible for getting rid of the stuff. And they have a very clever solution. And their clever solution is to parcel the excreta in wax needles. So there's actually a gland next to their anus from which there are wax needles which come out. These wax needles coat the entire plant gall. So I did mention, Denis Richard helped me with this. Nathan Pike was the ecologist who gave us the materials. So what's going on? Okay, what's going on? I told you that you need to actually solve this problem. The insects secrete and excrete wax needles. So if you look at the plant gall, so the nest of the insect, you look at the plant gall on the inside, this is essentially a cross-section, and you see it's microscopically rough. Okay, I can't remember what the scale bar is, but it's of the order of about maybe a millimeter or so. Okay, so they're microscopically rough. And you know what you would expect. In fact, if I have a microscopically rough surface and I had a drop of water, well, the drop of water couldn't get into all the roughnesses because the pressure required would be too large. So the water is almost in contact, almost everywhere in contact with just air. And therefore, without a calculation, you know that the contact angle is going to be very, very large. It's going to approach 180 degrees. That's great. So just because of mechanical roughness, I will actually get large contact angles, and therefore I actually will be essentially non-wetting. In addition, wax is already chemically hydrophobic. Okay, it doesn't like water very much, so the equilibrium contact angle even on a smooth surface is very large. And then for good measure, not only do I actually coat the plant gall surface with wax needles, but in fact, because the gland is right next to the anus, as water comes out, it actually coats. There are little needles which coat the drop, and so you have the drop as well coated with wax needles. And so, in fact, you see contact angles which are very large, 170 degrees or so. So it's a fantastic solution. And unlike, you know, something that, well, anyway, it basically used everything in the toolbox that you can possibly imagine. It's used the chemistry, it's used the structure of the surface on which it must move, and it uses the drop itself. It covers the drop. Why is that interesting? Well, it's interesting because from the point of view of physiology, these drops have to be moved out, and moved out quickly. You know that if I have a finite contact angle, it's difficult. It's difficult because I have a lot of resistance from the neighborhood of the contact line. So one, you've essentially got rid of, or you've actually almost gotten rid of, minimized the effects of contact line hysteresis. It's very easy to move. Two, it turns out, dynamically, it's actually, and this is might be surprising, it's actually more efficacious to take a puddle of water and break it into little drops, all of which are non-wetting, to move them out, rather than take the entire puddle. Okay. Again, I don't have time to actually go into the calculation. This is a calculation that we did a while ago, but we just used that over here. And when you use that over here, it turns out that by actually parceling a big puddle of water into little drops, in fact, the time taken actually decreases, depending on the size of the drops that you use. So it's a very, very nice, I think, way of perhaps explaining some of the physiology that the insects actually have to deal with, and maybe presenting a physical argument for why this is a clever solution, which of course now a lot of people in engineering and elsewhere are quite excited about. Okay, so that's the second little episode. The third episode that I'd like to actually tell you about involves cracking and how a suspension dries. I want to first then tell you about the phenomenology, and I'll tell you one little tidbit about a quantitative or a semi-quantitative calculation that we attempted. So this is the experiment that I showed you earlier. I have a Healy-Shaw thin cell, suspension in it, uniformly wetted initially, then it's still moist at the bottom. The top surface is actually exposed to the air, and so it dries from there. And as it dries, there's a drying front, which is indicated over here. Okay. Compaction front, compaction over here it's actually wet and loose. Over here it's not dry, but it's much, much more tightly packed. And the volume fraction of the particles essentially varies from 20 to about 60 when you go from this loose, wet region to this more dry but compact front. Okay, that's the first thing that you see. You actually have a compaction front which moves down, and then behind it you actually see a crack front. The crack front is defined as essentially the location of where the longest crack is at some particular time. And in fact, thirdly, I have movies, but I'm not going to actually bother to show them to you. In fact, the cracks don't move smoothly at all. The cracks jump. Okay, so basically, this compaction front moves very smoothly. The cracks jump. At a particular time, one crack is large, one crack is longer, and then at another time, basically, a second crack jumps, beats this crack, and so on. So you basically have this thick slip or intermittent cracking, which actually progresses. And I'll try and give you a qualitative explanation for most of it, and then give you a little quantitative reason for what the dynamics of the crack might look like in one of these drying suspensions. Why is it cracking? Well, it's cracking for two reasons. It's cracking, one, because you have associated with these very large capillary stresses at the top interface, where you have a meniscus. The particles, I forgot to mention, well, actually it's over there, the particles are very small. So they are, in fact, Brownian over here. And if I have very tightly packed particles, close to about 60% or so, typical radius of curvature is of the order of, again, a few nanometers, tens of nanometers. And if I basically look at the capillary stresses, they're very, very high, of the order of negative 100 atmospheres, massive capillary stresses. But that's not sufficient to actually cause cracking. Why? Because if I have a medium which is actually drying and somehow I'm able to suspend it, in fact, the medium can just collapse uniformly. I don't have to develop a stress. The second thing that I need is to actually attach it to a boundary. It has to be attached to a boundary, because what's happening, of course, is that in addition to generating this compressive strain, in fact, it's not allowed to actually have the compressive strain because it's attached to the boundary. And therefore, I get a huge tensile stress. And that huge tensile stress causes it to crack. Why do I emphasize this? I emphasize this because I don't have time to tell you about this, but if I have a drop on the other hand, and if I have a thin layer on the top, which is actually now contracting because the inside is losing water, it will buckle. It won't crack. But the reason is exactly the same. The question is, what are the boundary conditions allowing it to do? Are the boundary conditions such that it allows the suspension to contract or not? If it doesn't allow it to contract, you develop tensile stresses. If it does allow it to contract, you just contract. Okay, so if you look at the two fronts, here is what the compaction front looks like, more or less smooth. In fact, not surprisingly, it actually follows a diffusive behavior as a function of time. And here is the crack front, which, as I told you earlier, actually follows more or less this compaction front, but in fact follows it with these jumps. And these jumps essentially correspond to the fact that you have this discontinuous propagation. Well, why do you have this discontinuous propagation? You have it because, in fact, what's really happening is that I have a gradient of the stress as I move down, large stresses at the top, small stresses at the bottom. So the crack essentially has to first overcome, the solid has to first, in order to crack, overcome a nucleation barrier for the crack to actually start. Once the crack essentially starts, so you've got basically the nucleation energy, the crack runs. Okay. But as the crack runs, it's actually moving into a region of lower and lower stress, because it's actually moving in a gradient field. And as it actually moves down, it extinguishes itself. Once it extinguishes itself, it turns out it starts to become blunt. And this is the reason why you have a different stress intensity factor, if you want, or a different stress macroscopically, at which the crack stops and at which the crack starts, which you can sort of see when you look at essentially the tip of the crack. After a while, the crack blunts, so it takes a lot of energy, a lot of stress to actually start the crack. Once it's moving during propagation, it's very sharp. So there's a difference, and this is roughly similar. It's very similar to what you know from friction. You have a different coefficient of friction when it's actually starting to start motion compared to when it's actually moving. Okay, so I'm going to stop by basically telling you about what an individual crack looks like, moves like, and give you a little theory for that. This is a high-speed imaging focused on the crack. Look at the time scales. So you go down to millisecond time scales, and then you look at essentially a single crack. You look at a single crack, and then you see that, in fact, as a function of time, look at how the crack length is changing, and you see that essentially initially it starts out. Look at this log-log plot. It starts out with a slope 0.5, so it looks like it's diffusive propagation at short time, and then at long time, basically, it saturates and stops. The fact that it stops is not surprising. I already told you why, because essentially moving into a region of lower and lower stress, so it basically will stop. What is interesting and perhaps surprising is this diffusive behavior, because you know, if I think about crack motion in brittle solids, in fact, it's dominated by the propagation or the ability to actually send out waves, phonons, from where the crack tip is, and so I don't expect this diffusive behavior. So where is that coming from? So this is the same thing now for a number of cracks. They see more or less, you see this more or less the same behavior, diffusive behavior at short times, and then it starts to saturate. And the answer is essentially you want to think about this as you should, because in terms of a porous material made of grains through which a fluid is actually moving. Okay, that's a theory which goes back a long time to Biot, not the Biot of Biot Savart, another Biot. And I want to actually tell you a little implication of that and stop. How do you understand dynamics of the crack? Well, you can write down the equations of Biot, the poroelasticity equations, or you can be rather cavalier, as I will be, and just do a simple energy balance. What I'm going to do is basically tell you what I think everybody will agree with, which is that there is some energy that's actually stored in the stressed solid associated with the drying. And that stored energy, as the crack moves, is converted to some viscous dissipation. And that's the new part, because I have a fluid, and I have to have that fluid move relative to the particles as the crack moves. And then there is another part, which is much more traditional, which is the energy associated with opening up an interface. Okay? If I dropped this viscous dissipation part, and I just said elastic energy is equal to the interfacial energy, or look at the rates, then in fact I recover what is well known as the Griffith theory of fracture. If I don't, I have this new term associated with viscous dissipation. At short times, the stress hasn't had enough chance to actually decrease to its equilibrium value in the absence of any motion. So in fact, I'm going to say that the stress, the power associated with elasticity goes as the energy density, which is sigma squared, sigma being the stress, divided by E, times the thickness of the material, thickness of the Heeley-Shaw cell squared, and it's basically moving a distance L in a time dt, dl in a time dt, so basically I have an elastic power associated with that formula over there. On the right side, I have two terms. This is the standard term, interfacial energy times the thickness of the material again, because the crack essentially goes all the way through, again times the distance over which it's actually moving, or the velocity in this case, because I'm thinking about the power, which is L dot. And the new term over here is the viscous dissipation. Okay, so the assumption that I made over here is that most of the viscous dissipation is actually occurring in the neighborhood of the crack tip over a characteristic size, which is essentially the particle size, because I expect that in fact, fine, thanks, I'll be done actually earlier than that. Essentially over a few particle sizes, so I forget that prefactor of a few particle sizes, so the strain gradient, velocity gradient is essentially the velocity of the crack divided by that typical distance, the volume over which I'm actually dissipating that energy is essentially the crack width, with the equilibrium displacement through which it moves, times the depth, which is h, times essentially some geometric factor, which of course depends on L and also depends on the angle, which I've actually ignored. Okay? So you basically take that equation and you invert it so that you actually have an expression for L dot. And not a big surprise, perhaps, or maybe it's a big surprise, you actually find that you can explain this diffusive behavior. At short times, which means that my stress is small, sigma c is small compared to sigma. Sigma c is the stress which I require to initiate the crack. Sigma is the current state of stress associated with the fact that I've actually enormously stressed the material. So this quantity is small. So I get L dot is this hydraulic permeability times the base stress divided by L, or equivalently L, L dot is some constant, and therefore I basically get L is going to the square root of time. Okay, and then at long times you expect this exponential decay, because I can do an expansion now for sigma in the neighborhood of sigma c, and if I do that, I will also pick up this exponential. So I can pick up both limits. In fact, that's actually exactly soluble, but it's not very useful. It's better to look at the limits. Okay, and I should say that in fact, now you can collapse all the data, or not now, but you can collapse all the data. There are now to collapse the data, it's been deliberately chosen. The data has been deliberately collapsed so that I pick up my tau, which depends on details of what the stress is, the permeability and the geometry for each individual crack, and y over delta, delta being essentially the total distance that the crack actually propagated, and indeed you see a reasonable collapse. So all these numbers, sigma c, eta, rp, and so on, are essentially what are used to determine delta and tau. All right, so I'm actually done with this episodic view. I'll maybe tell you in 1 minute. How much time do I have, really? It's over. Okay, so I'll stop. Then I won't tell you about. I know I've overrun. No. All right, so I want to stop by actually telling you about two new things which I didn't talk about, but which I think are interesting. One, I told you about particle rafts, and I told you about their elasticity. I didn't tell you about the dynamic fracture. We are actually currently looking at how these cracks move. The thing that I want to tell you about is an interesting, which you heard a lot about over here, is an interesting set of experiments done actually by a colleague of mine, Howard Stone, or a student of his, where they actually started to look at this way of encapsulating drops, but as a way of encapsulating, instead of drops, of encapsulating bubbles. So you armor a bubble. Okay? Why were they interested in this? Well, they were interested in this because if you armor the bubble, it actually really is stronger, in fact, to deformations of various kinds. And what they found, and in fact, what actually we had looked at but never actually focused on already in this insect, is that an armored bubble, or in fact, an armored or encapsulated drop, can have very different shapes. It doesn't have to be spherical anymore. Of course, it doesn't have to be spherical because I can support anisotropic stresses because it's an elastic solid. So you can do all kinds of manipulations. You can take a drop and you can squeeze it or stretch it and do all kinds of deformations, and you can go from, in fact, a sphere to something which is relatively elliptical. You've got to be careful, ellipsoidal, you've got to be careful because you've got to ask whether there are enough layers. And so of course, I'm monkeying around. I have to control both the volume and the surface to actually be able to do that. So there's an interesting question over here, a general question, which is, what can we say about these armored single layer drops, bubbles, and so on from the point of view of inelastic behavior? I don't have an answer. There are some experiments underway. That's one thing that I want to at least raise as perhaps an interesting thing to think about. I didn't at all tell you about some work that we've done, and we're still continuing to do. I just mentioned it, associated with these shells. Okay, if I form. Fine, so I'll stop. You can read this. And here's a puzzle.
Well, we do have time for questions. With those surfactants that formed, when you deform them, do they stay in equilibrium? I mean, it's...
You mean the cracks?
No, the last thing you showed with those bubbles that you, if you deform them, do they remain in their deformed state? They do not go to equilibrium?
You mean the armored bubbles? I didn't show them, but I talked about
them. Yeah, you just talked about it. But I'm interested in this because I'm thinking about
they'll
something
stay.
Else. They'll stay there. Their energy barrier to go back is...
Yeah, and the energy barrier comes from the fact that I have to have the grains move over each other. Mm-hmm. Okay, and these are athermal systems, so that's not going to happen. I mean, it might happen, but it's going to take forever. So the answer is yes. You can actually control the shape, and you can statically, once you've got a shape that you want, you can actually keep it there. Yeah.
Two questions regarding the first section. You have a characteristic LC, which basically depends on gamma.
Yes.
Where does the temperature, thermodynamic temperature, comes in compared to the granular temperature? If I believe that this is would be some kind of a granular.
There is no.
You assume that the surface tension is not dependent on temperature.
Oh. No, the surface tension, of course, is dependent on temperature. I wasn't quite sure when you said that.
LC, your gamma was inside the LC formula.
Yeah.
Do you have any experimental data that describe how it changes with temperature?
I'm not sure I understand. Gamma is just the bare interfacial tension of the interface.
Right.
So we never monkey around with that. We don't change the temperature or anything like that.
No. Okay. Now the length scale in the last portion, you were talking about particle size. You're talking about drying out of paints. Where were the particles? Feelers?
Okay. Paints are more complicated. Paints basically have, you know, titanium oxide and all kinds of particles. And in addition, typically more modern paints have polymers, okay, so that these particles essentially get fixed in them. I was using paint as an analogy, but all those experiments were done just with simple particles, okay, either with colloidal particles or with things called nanolatex, which is 50, 100 nanometers in size. There was nothing else, and water.
Is there any other question? If not, I'd like to thank this and other speakers this afternoon. Thank you.